This morning I want to speak on the subject of there is a God. Actually, it's an examination of Genesis 1, and this is the song that we chose to attach to it. But what we want to emphasize this morning is that we're presently engaged in a great conflict. We're in, as Brother Cox says, there's a war going on, and there's two major opponents in this war, and one of them is Christianity. And the other one is a secular worldview. Sometimes it rides under the name of atheism, theological liberalism, modernism, rationalism, humanism, naturalism. But all of them say that there is no God and there are no miracles that occur in the world. We see this battle raging in some of the moral conflicts that have happened in America. Since 1973, over 50 million Americans have lost their lives in a doctor's clinic, and an abortion place. In the 1960s, a sexual revolution occurred in our country, and fornication, sex outside the blessings of the wedlock of marriage, began to happen, and its unintended consequences of absentee fathers is destroying the inner cities and homes all over America. And I don't think any of us who've watched any television cannot perceive how that homosexuality, preaching that it is an acceptable form of behavior, is being thrust down the throats of the American people, leading to changes in civil law, authorizing and granting same-sex marriage in our states. And no-fault divorce that began in the 1960s has had its impact on our country as well. Yes, we are in the conflict, and some of the main issues are, is there a God? Is the Bible a divine revelation? Have miracles occurred? And is there an absolute moral law governing mankind? Is there a judgment, a heaven and a hell? And even today, are religious values even welcome in the public square? One of the Alabama judges got in quite a bit of trouble because he had the Ten Commandments in the public square. And I think he lost his job over the thing, as I recall. Is he welcome at the courthouse and in the schools of our country? Well, one area in which this conflict has focused itself, where the two views collide, is in the count of creation. The biblical view is that God created the heavens and earth in 6 days. The secular worldview is that the world began as a result of a big bang, and it has evolved over billions of years. And of course, this focuses us on what is the meaning of Genesis chapter 1. However, we must not reach the idea that Genesis 1 is isolated. Creation permeates the Bible. The word creation appears in 13 verses. The creature appears 26 times in the singular and 28 times in the plural. Create occurs in other verses of Scripture besides Genesis 1. And created in the past tense in over 40 verses of Scripture that are posted there. God is called our Creator. And we also notice then that creation is not a doctrine isolated to Genesis 1. Creation then becomes a part of the foundation for other doctrines to be taught. Paul argues in 1 Corinthians 11, 8 and 9 that the role of man and woman was defined by the order of creation. And the creation of man is appealed to in Jesus' teaching about divorce and remarriage. When we come to creation in the New Testament, the worlds are framed by the Word of God, not from the things that are seen. God's supremacy over His creation, including His supremacy over man, stems from the fact that God is the one who made us. He is our Creator. And in the great throne scene of Revelation chapter 4, one of the reasons why we should praise God, the Father, is stated, "You are worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power. For you created all things, and by your will they exist and were created." To the degree that we remove God from his role in creation, we make him that much less praiseworthy. So our homage to God is rooted in the fact that he is our creator. I like to put Genesis chapter 1 in its biblical context, if we can. Genesis 1 in the Bible is that it is the first book of the first portion of the Bible. The Bible made up of 66 books. Genesis is the first one. Genesis 1 is the first chapter. But in a smarter context, it's the first of five books, the Torah, the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, the law, and Deuteronomy. It's the law. And Genesis 1 fits in as the foundation and background for the totality of God's revelation. We can look at its place also in the book of Genesis from another point of view, looking at the organization and structure of the book of Genesis. Genesis is divided into two major sections. One of them, Genesis 1 through 11, which is called primeval history. And it covers the background for the whole human race, not just those of Israel, but for all of mankind. It covers 11 chapters. And then we begin with the story of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, the history of the patriarchs of Israel. And by the allocation of the space that is there, we can already see a purpose of what the book of Genesis is. Its focus is to give us the history of God's people, Israel, introducing us to the theme of redemption. But Genesis can also be broken down and organized by a phrase that occurs in the Hebrew Bible as Ele Toledoth, or Ele Toldoth. But you see it in the King James Version, these are the generations of. If you notice that in reference to the book of Genesis, there are 10 of those sections. And when you have a split in the genealogy that is there, the system is get rid of the less important person first and concentrate on the one that has the most to do with redemption history. And following these generations that are there, we have also an outline of the book. Now, the book of Genesis, and especially Genesis chapter 1, is a beautiful piece of literature. The Hebrew scholar from the Bar Ilan University of Tel Aviv, Umberto Casuto, called my attention to how the number 7 plays in the book of Genesis. There are 7 paragraphs in Genesis chapter 1. There are 7 days of creation, and a number of words occur in multiples of 7. God, for example, between Genesis 1:1 and 2:4 occurs 35 times. The word heavens, 21 times. Earth, 21 times. Verse 1 has 7 words. Verse 2, 14 words. The last section, chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, has 35 words, 5 times 7. The divine evaluation, it was good, occurs 7 times. There are 7 commands for creation. Light and day are found 7 times in the first paragraph. There are 7 references to light in the fourth paragraph. Water appears 7 times in paragraphs 2 and 3. And when you look at Genesis 1 through chapter 4, God's name appears 70 times. And the last one says, "Then began man to call upon the name of the Lord." That's probably not just a coincidence. And what I'm trying to get you to see, it is a beautiful tapestry. And when we start pulling threads out and changing it and giving it a new meaning, we mess up the picture that God has painted in this tapestry. We must be very careful to realize it is a beautiful literary production that should not be altered, changed, or twisted to fit some contemporary explanation of how the world came into existence or what man is. That's the first thing I want us to look at about that. When we start playing with it, we mess it up. So now let's look at the 7 days of creation. The 7 days of creation are part of a historical narrative. They are not a literary framework. Now, there is a literary framework that plays in Genesis, but it is not the days of creation. When you look at the framework, we've all seen this when we've taught Genesis 1 to the children. The correspondence between day 1 and day 4, day 2 and day 5, and day 3 and day 6. That in the beginning, God creates light. In day 4, there's the sun, moon, and stars. He separates the waters above the heavens from the waters below the heavens, creating the firmament where the birds fly and where the sea, where the fish swim. And then on the sixth day and the third day, there's correspondence as well. Now, sometimes this is presented in a chart like that, but if you were to look at it from the structure of Hebrew narrative, you would see it usually diagrammed more like this, where that you have A that corresponds to A prime, B to B prime, C1 correspond to C1 prime, and C2 prime, they correspond to each other in a pattern. Now, what happens in that is you then have the ability to give an emphasis to something by noticing something that doesn't have a match. Now, when you read Genesis 1, where is it that we all see the emphasis is? It's, let us make man in our image. In the image of God created him, male and female created him. And look which one that is. That's this one here. It has no match. And it stands out like a sore thumb. This is the point. Man is made in the image of God. And so here's the Hebrew structure of Genesis chapter 1. Now, when the days are recounted, they follow a frame pattern. They go like this. God said, and then there is a creative command. And then there is the statement that God accomplished what he said he would do. And then the statement, and it was so. And then it closed with God saw that it was good. Now there's your frame for how the book of Genesis was written. And you think about how this is being transmitted from one generation to another, how this would be a great memory device to help you to memorize that. Just like they said, we had the 12 apostles, how we know them, Jesus called them one by one. There's your memory device. And here's your memory device as well. But we have in day 1, God said, let there be light, and there was light. And it was so. It's lacking in the first day. And as we saw in the chart, there are some exceptions to this. But generally, this is the way it is. And then God saw that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the water, and let it divide the waters from the waters. Thus God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. Here's the fulfillment, you see. And it was so. And God saw that it was good. And this goes through the sequence of the 6 days. And at the end of the 6 days, you have this statement, God saw that it was very good. You've all called attention. And what he's saying is, it's just exactly like I want it. And in the world that he created that was just exactly like I wanted, it was a world in which the devil could tempt man. You know, if God wanted the earth to be like heaven, he could have made it that way then. But he wanted it where the free will man could make a choice of whether to serve God or not to serve God. This is exactly the way I want it. And so as I see this, the frame is not the 7 days of creation. The frame is this panel writing. And by the way, panel writing occurs also in the genealogies in chapter 5 and chapter 6, or chapter 11. It occurs in the dedication of the gifts to the tabernacle by the 12 tribes, the princes of the 12 tribes in Numbers 7. It's a very common Hebrew device that is used for giving things that look repetitious to us. It helped them to remember. But as we look at this, the days of creation are not the frame. They're part of the historical narrative. But the word day itself, when it appears in the creation narrative, is defined for us by an appositional phrase. I might say, This is Lewis Willis. He's my brother, the brother of Cecil Willis. And here I've given by this appositional phrase the meaning of the word, Lewis Willis, what who he is. It was evening and morning, day one. What is day? It consists of an evening and a morning. And then when you come to the narrative in Genesis 2, 1 through 3, God rested the seventh day. Well, what day is he talking about? Well, he's reminding them that the Sabbath was hallowed because this was the day in which God rested. Now, the interesting thing about that is all scholars are agreed with that. The modernist and the evangelical scholars are agreed with this. The modernist will say, yes, Moses wrote of 7 24-hour days, but that's the reason we know it's myth and legend, because science shows that the world's way too old. And the evangelicals say, yes, he spoke of 7 24-hour days, and that's why we know evolution cannot be true, is because it doesn't fit what God's revelation says. But there's a group of people that's trying to hold on to the Bible on one hand and their scientific theories on the other hand, and they try to pull these together to make them fit, and they say, well, the days of creation have got to be long periods of time. What I'm trying to emphasize in this is, number one, it cannot be made. It's a middle-of-the-road position that cannot be defended from a biblical point of view. Now, as we look at this, one of the rules you have is you say, if there's a question about what did the author mean, let's let the author tell us himself what he means. The author of Genesis 1 also wrote the rest of the Pentateuch in two different times. He told us what day meant. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Why? For in 6 days the Lord created the heavens. How long did it take, Moses? Now, if you don't know what day means in Genesis 1, here he'll tell you what day means. And again in the 31st chapter, you shall keep the Sabbath. Why? For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth. Now, if we want to know what Moses meant, let's let Moses tell us what he meant. Isn't that clear and easy to see? Now, the other part is that if Moses wanted to use different words for time, he could have. The Hebrew vocabulary is rich in reference to words of time. He could have used the word day, which is what he did use, yom, or the word week, shabuah, or the word month, the words for the seasons, the harvest time and the seed time, the time of the early rain and the latter rain, the summer. He could have used the word shana if it had meant by years. And if he wanted to talk about a lot of years, he had the language to say a lot of years. They counted the people who were soldiers in Israel in Numbers, the 2nd chapter, and there were 603,550 fighting men at that time. He could write big numbers if he wanted big numbers. And if he wanted them to be long, extended periods of time, he could have used olam. Moses had the vocabulary to have said long periods of time, but he said day. And he defined it evening and morning, day one. And so we understand from that the creation narrative, as it speaks to us about creation, Moses used the words God gave him to use. And he spoke of the days of creation as days of a 24-hour nature. Now, the creation narrative was controversial from the day it came from Moses' hand. Now, that's something I overlooked for years, didn't see that. Genesis must be read in its context. To properly understand a text, one must know its social context. If I said, for example, teenage boy drove up in, now I fill in the blank, Mercedes, Volkswagen. They mean different things, don't they? Now, if I were 500 years removed from that, They may not even have cards there. That, you know, we're going to be in those little things that fly around. Everybody's going to have his little portable airplane like the Jetsons do. They won't know what a Mercedes and a Volkswagen is. But because we live in this context, we can see a big difference in that boyfriend driving up in the front of our house in his little Volkswagen and that boyfriend driving up in the front of the house in his Mercedes. And by the way, because we miss that context, we don't sometimes see what happened when Abraham's servant, he comes to the house of Laban on having 10 camels. Now, if you go back and read Genesis, they'll say, when was the camel domesticated? And they'll say, one of the errors in Genesis is because camel wasn't domesticated that early. And now they've been finding some archaeological evidence of it. And what the situation was, rich people could have camels. Poor people used the little donkeys that were there. And when this man comes up with 10 camels loaded with gifts, Laban caught it. Here's a rich man, get him over to my house. And it just happens he's a relative. Woo, boy, that's all good too, you know. Now, that's how essential it is that we catch the context of this. Now, when we come to the creation narrative, what was the social context that was existing then? And what we began to see is that the world was given to idolatry. We see echoes of this in the warnings against idolatry. Don't make a graven image like male or female or an animal that's on the earth, the birds that fly in the air, the things that creep on the earth. All this language that is there in Genesis 1 is part of the warnings against idolatry that is there. And you just automatically bring those two together in your mind. But look how it happened in Genesis 1. In the contemporary Near Eastern thought of that time, they thought the world was consisting of many different gods at war with each other. Nobody could have read Genesis 1 without looking. This is a monotheistic document. It's not a document that is full of different gods. One of the gods they worshiped was light. But he said, no, light is not a god. God created light. And another one that was there, the heavens were formed. They had this myth in ancient Babylon that one of the gods was killed and the body was torn apart, and half of it they used to make the heavens and half of it they used to make the sea. And the text says, no. God made the heavens. God made the sea. And the seas sometimes were said to be under Tiamat. And she was at war with other gods, but God is the one that made the sea. It's not that the seas are a god. The sun and the moon and the stars were worshipped as gods. When we have the name of the Hebrew town Beth Shemesh, the house of the sun was a sun god, and a temple was made there. But whenever Moses gives the account, he won't even use the word sun, Shemesh. He doesn't use the word for moon. He says, the greater light and the lesser light. Lest somebody get confused about, no, they're not gods. They're something God made. And Babylonian thought, you had the idea that the stars control our destiny. Oh, they still have that at Kroger's, don't they? You can buy those. The stars don't control our destinies. God made the stars. God controls our destiny. And the animals that are there were objects of worship. The Apis bull down in Egypt. The little frog statues that are there. The crocodile statues that are seen in the museums of the gods that they worshipped. These animals are not gods. God made the animals. And the sea monsters that God also made. The sea monster was a chaos deity doing battle with other gods, but God made the sea monster too. And then the fertility of plants and animals. You go down and you worship at the fertility goddess. So that your gods, worship of the fertility gods, make your cow have calves and your you have triplet lambs. No, God made man able to have children and animals to be fertile. And then man was created in the ancient ideas. The gods didn't want to work anymore, so they created man to do their work for them. And he said, no, man is created to have dominion over God's creation. Man offers his sacrifices to feed the gods. No, God feeds man. And in ancient thought, the only person that had the image of God was the king. But no, God made all of us, male and female, in his image. Now, I say this to say, we read that text, but if we don't understand its social context, we'll forget what a controversial document that was when it came from the hand of Moses. But let me tell you for sure, none of his contemporaries would have missed it. It was a controversial document when it came from his hands, and here's a shocker for you, it still is controversial. Because you see, you have two cultures in conflict. Polytheism on the one side and monotheism, the worship of God, on the other. And now we've got creation on one side, the worship of the Christian God on one side, and secularism on the other. Now, we'd be naive if we didn't take the time to talk about how this document is controversial in our day as well, wouldn't we? The first thing we'd notice is what you have is in the first verse, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. You got God versus the idea of random evolution, that everything's just happening by chance. Man then begins to try to explain the world without God. The universe is self-existing. Matter is eternal. There are no supernatural influences. You had a big bang that happened, followed by billions of years of unguided evolution. But God says simply, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And let me tell you to you, both views cannot be right. You cannot marry them. It's one or the other of them. And the operative energy in the two different views is in conflict as well. The operative energy in the biblical narrative is God, who speaks his word, let there be. And when he speaks, that's all the energy it takes for it to happen. But the operative energy here is the Big Bang. I had to get my mind around the Big Bang. So I read Stephen Hawking, who is a very widely respected scientist of our day. He moves around like, I think it's Jeremy here, in a wheelchair, and he has very much physical debilities, but he's got a beautiful mind, apparently. And he's trying to figure out the world divorced from God. And so they start measuring the expansion of the universe and the rate at which it expands, and then put that in reverse. If it's expanding at this rate, what was it like a year ago? 10 years ago? And what they get is that if you keep going back, it gets back down to infinity small. And they say what had to happen is at one time, the whole universe was smaller than an atom, and then you had this big bang that happened. Now stop and think about that. I got a sheet of paper. I'm going to get it small and smaller and smaller. I can't even get it the size of a pinhead. But now that's not enough. We got to get this building. We got to take it down to the cruncher, and we got to crunch it and crunch it till it's smaller than the head of a pin. No, it's so small you can't even see it. No, that's not enough. We got to get Athens. We got to get a whole area of Athens and reduce it down. No, Alabama. The North American cut the size of a pinhead. No, the universe. And they tell us the light from the stars left there 240 million years ago to get here, but we got to get all of that space down into the head of a pin, and then that's much too big, because an atom, you can see the head of a pin, you can't see an atom. And people tell us that once this explosion happened, you had this cooling that happened at astronomical rates, and the expanding begins to occur, followed by billions of years of human evolution. And some people have the idea that this is the Creator's best friend. The Big Bang Theory is not the Creator's friend. Now, it might point to the fact that the universe had a beginning, but this theory does not harmonize with divine revelation, and it never will and never can. The operative energy in this is the natural forces of nature. And what we ask is, can happenstance explain what is? Let's suppose today that I had a bushel basket. I just emptied out the peas that I'd been picking, and I filled it full of letters. And I take this bushel basket over here, and I turn it upside down and just let it spill out. And I look over this bushel basket, and I say, oh, look, there's the word "and." Possible that, pretty easy. Or, look, there's the word "the." There's where I, but suppose all of a sudden I looked down there and I saw, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. You know what you'd say? Somebody been messing with those letters. He put them in some kind of a sequence, didn't he? And what is going on now is that what we've illustrated here has such a remote possibility of it happening that we would say somebody had to be interfering to cause that to happen. But what we have in our universe, excuse me, is much more complicated than that. The brain, the nervous system, the digestive system, the eye, the ear, the cardiovascular system, all of these things are terribly complex in their nature. And you don't have to watch very many of the nature channels. If they're talking about a mouse in its environment, or they're talking about a tadpole in its environment, you see the hand of a God that fitted the environment to what was there. And what is the result is that some of the scientists today are realizing from the complexity of what is today that something had to have been operating to cause that complexity. They call it the intelligent design argument. And that's something that's going to have some merit as we learn more and more about it to show the weaknesses of the secular worldview. Now, in the secular worldview, time is required. As a matter of fact, some have said time becomes God. The naturalist needs billions of years to allow happenstance evolution to occur. And there's no problem for an evolutionist to say, well, we were off by 200 billion years. I mean, 200 billion years, that's sort of like you throw around. It's nothing. But the biblical narrative, my friends, will not allow that kind of room for time. It's interesting to me to read the biblical account of time. And what I find in Bible chronology is it's amazingly precise. When we go back to the time of Jesus, the birth of Jesus is in the reign of Herod the Great. He ruled from 37 to 4 B.C. All your encyclopedias will tell you that. Jesus had to have been born somewhere between 6 and 4 B.C. And whenever he cleanses the temple in John, the second chapter, he said, destroy this temple and I'll raise it up in 3 days. And the people said, this temple has been 46 years in the building. Because you see, in 20 B.C., Herod the Great started remodeling the temple in the city of Jerusalem. And so that incident happened in 26 A.D. That's pretty precise, isn't it? 2,000 years ago, we know that goes back that far. The Babylonian captivity, man, you can date that. There are three different invasions that happened. One in 606 when Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego was captured. They came back in the times of Jehoiakim in 597. Jerusalem fell on March 16th, 597. That's pretty precise, isn't it? They can tell that from the archaeological excavations that have been done and documents that have been found that tie it to eclipses. And that's how accurate they are with biblical chronology. The first submission, 606, the second one, 597, the third, and the fall of Jerusalem, 587. We go back to the times of Saul, David, and Solomon. Assyrian captivity, 722. Saul, David, and Solomon. Dated 1050 to 930. And there's a statement, 1 Kings 6, verse 1, that in the fourth year of Solomon, they began to construct the temple. And that was 480 years after the Exodus. Now that ties you now to the Exodus at 1446. Now there is a bit of discussion about the Exodus, of whether the 215 years of the time measures from Abraham to the giving of the law, as it appears from Galatians 3:17, or whether it is measured from the time that they went in under Joseph until the giving of the law, as it appears in Exodus 12:40. And so you have about a 200-year discrepancy trying to understand the biblical text. You'll have some Bible scholars date the Exodus at 1225, others 1445. I'm a 1445 in my opinion. But it brings Abraham back to 19 to 2100 B.C. About a 200-year discrepancy there. First of all, I'd say 200 years compared to 200 million years or billion years, that's nothing. Bible scholars are rather universally agreed about these dates. You won't find argument amongst them. And that leaves 11 chapters of Genesis to fit 4 billion years of human evolution in. Now you think about, where are we going to fit 4 billion years in 11 chapters? Especially when it's made like this. There's creation. The text gives us 10 generations. 10 generations says A lived X number of years and begat B. A lived Y number of years after he begat B and begat sons and daughters. The total years of A were Z number of years. And that repeats 10 times in Genesis 5. And then when we come down, we have the flood, about a year of time there. And then we have 10 generations. Actually, Genesis gives 9 generations, but the book of Luke mentions a person who lived between the time of Salah and Arphaxad. And because of that person being there, it made it fit 10 generations again. And the Septuagint had the same thing as Luke had. And people think probably a generation fell out there. So we have another 10 generations. And it has this style. A lived X number of years and begat B. A lived Y number of years after he begat B and begat sons and daughters. So we have 20 generations of time, and some people will say, well, you have in these genealogies, don't you have telescoping? And what they mean by telescoping is the leaving out of generations, and there are times when you have that happen in genealogies. For example, you will have Jesus, the son of Abraham, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Well, there are some generations left out, aren't they? You have vertical genealogies and horizontal genealogies. In a vertical genealogy, you're trying to show this person is the descendant of this person. That's why he has authority. Jesus is the son of David, of the tribe of Judah. Why? To show he has the authority to be the Messiah. But you also have some that go like this. Moab and Ammon are related to Lot. Why? Because they're kin to each other. And we treat our kin folks different than we do other people. That's why our tribe can have something to do with the Moabites and the Ammonites, but not with the Canaanites. That's the point that is made there. Now, when we come to this telescoping, We only know if there's telescoping if there is another text that shows us the omission of a generation. Problem is, we don't have any other text for that period of time. We couldn't prove telescoping if our life depended on it, because there's no other information that is there. And what is the benefit of a genealogy if we have 20 names for 4 billion years? And you do your math, 20 names into 4 billion, we got one name for every 200 million years. That's not much of a genealogy, is it? And what it shows to us is that these two philosophies that we have, they conflict in a number of different ways and area, especially in time, and there's no way for them to be together. Well, I'm running out of time so quickly that I stop at this point and make this concluding observation. The rest of this material is in the book, and you can read it. But the ramifications of this conflict is here, spills down to the whole revelation. What the secular worldview about the Bible is different from ours. We believe it's an inspired word of God. They believe the Bible is man groping to find this possibly existing mysterious God. We believe Jesus is the Christ. They believe Jesus was the illegitimate son of Mary, who claimed to heal like faith healers do today, who was a mistaken and delusional apocalyptic prophet that was such a threat to the political stability of the time that the Romans properly took him out and crucified him. They believe that the church that we have is not the church that God created and planned and brought into existence. We understand the church is here because the God of all heaven planned it and set it up the way it was. They believe that the church is something that's outdated and it needs to really adjust itself, change what it believes, change what its mission is. But finally, what has to happen is that we've got to get rid of the church as an outdated institution. And they say, while we're over here believing there is a judgment and a heaven and a hell, no, there's no judgment. Ethics are situational and personal, and what's right for you may be wrong for somebody else. And don't believe in a pie in the sky and the sweet by and by, because that's not going to happen. And what we've got to do is spend our time creating our heaven here on earth. And so you have in modern preaching the elimination of much preaching about hell, fire, and brimstone, standing for God in judgment. All of this is the ramifications of this split, this major battle that is occurring among us. So Genesis 1 is one of the foundation texts for this. It's not the only one. But we better be geared up to do battle. We better be teaching our children what the issues are and helping them to see what the God of heaven has said. In the 1960s, Time magazine comes out with a periodical that has red cover on it, and the very front of it said, "God is dead," with a question mark after it. There was a preacher in Indiana named A.W. Dicus. A.W. Dicus had gone to a small college in Marion, Indiana. It was called, if I recall, Marion Normal. He then goes down to Indiana University and he gets a BS degree, BA degree there, a Master of Science degree there, and a PhD, and begins teaching at Indiana University. His career in education took him several places. He worked with General Motors for a time, and he was the one that invented the turn signal on our cars. A.W. had a son named John Dicus, who lives right outside of Cleveland, Ohio, and he preaches at the Lorraine Avenue Church there in Cleveland, Ohio. I've had the pleasure of being in their home on more than one occasion. But as Brother Dykus saw this issue of Time magazine, he was moved to respond to it with a song. There is beyond the azure blue a God concealed from human sight. He's tinted skies with heavenly hue and framed the world with his great might. Secure from his life from mortal mind, God holds the germ within his hand. Though men may search, they cannot find, for God alone does understand. There is a God, he is alive. In him we live and we survive. From dust our God created man. He is our God, the great I am. Lewis, will you lead us in that good song?
He tinted skies with heavenly hue and framed the worlds with his great might.
There is a God,
he is alive. In him we live and we survive. From dust our God created man. He is our God, the great I am. There was a long, long time ago a God whose voice the prophets heard. He is the God that we should know, who speaks from his inspired word.
There is a God,
he is alive. In him we live and we survive. From dust our God created man. He is our God, the great I am. Secure is life from mortal mind. God holds the germ within his hand. Though men may search, they cannot find, for God alone does understand.
There is a God,
he is alive. In him we live and we survive. From dust our God created man. He is our God, the great I am. Our God, whose son upon a tree a life was willing there to give, that he from sin might set man free and evermore with him could live.
There is a God,
he is alive. In him we live and we survive. From dust our God created man. He is our God.